session number 25054, Reel 10.
Derek Plummer, Reel 10.
Yes.
So, impulsive then is pensioned off.
Pensioned off, yes. Broken up.
And you went to where?
I went to Liverpool to join a destroyer. Now I was a first lieutenant, so I'm, and it was Escapade.
Escapade.
Mm.
This is a destroyer.
A destroyer, yes. And she'd been damaged, a self-inflicted wound, and was being mended in Liverpool.
Right. When you say self-inflicted wound.
Well, she was one of the. You see, one of the problems with conventional anti-submarine warfare was that you had depth charges on your quarterdeck, the back of the ship, and you fire patterns and drop them, and all this lands on the, with luck, on the submarine. It forces the surface. But if you stop to think of it, all this is going on behind you, because you're going this way, and your quarterdeck is the back. So it means you've got to actually go over the target, and having picked him up in front, you have to go over him and drop depth charges on him when he's underneath you, so they may take a time to sink. And this is very inconvenient. It would be much better if you could attack them when they're in front of you. So they invented a thing called Hedgehog, and it was fitted on the forecastle of a ship right back. It took a gun away and fitted Hedgehog instead. It was called Hedgehog because there were 24 spindles so sticking up in the air, like regimented soldiers there, on a thing about as big as that. And these 24 sockets or spindles accepted a bomb, a little bomb with a hollow in it, so they dropped down, and the bomb was then fired, the whole lot, the pattern was fired in one fell sweep. It could only do it once, and they all went in front and dropped on the submarine when it was ahead. And if one went off, all the rest, if it hit the ship, it went off. Now, you can't have the bombs up there ready to go off at the slightest hit, or some sailor would fall over it and the ship would be burnt to bits. So it has an impeller on it, and as that went into the water, the impeller, the water movement, and finally the bomb, as it's dropping through the water, becomes charged and ready, and the slightest contact, it's going to blow. There is a safety catch to stop the impeller being turned accidentally on the forecastle, and whoever was in charge of the forecastle party before, long before I joined the ship, had forgotten to after an exercise, they'd forgotten to put the safety clips on, and they went to sea, and it was fairly heavy sea, and one wave after another went over, and finally one of them had had enough water to all the turns on the thing, and the next bump, the whole lot went on. A lot of people were badly damaged, including Lieutenant Commander Peake, who was the captain then. He wasn't when I joined, he'd left. He was looking over the gyro compass, which is a heavy steel thing, and you could see the, and that blew up in his face. And he flattened most of his face out. He had it repaired, but he was never quite the same again after that. So it was a self-inflicted wound. They had to do a lot of repairs to the ship. And I joined her with a new captain, wonderful man called Bom Kidston, K-I-D-S-T-O-N, Kidston. One of two brothers who had been put in the Navy. His brother was a commander who had, for some reason, in peacetime, before the war, he was a commander of an aircraft carrier. He had a drink in the wardroom and said he was going out for a breath of fresh air. They were at sea. He went up onto the flight deck, got into an aircraft. He'd never flown one in his life. Told a couple of ratings to take the chocks away. He started up, drove off, and he was never seen again, never heard or seen of again. Quite extraordinary. His brother, Hume Kidston, that was Glenn Kidston. Hume Kidston was my new captain, tall, enormously powerfully built, very, very good looking, had only two interests in life. One was horse racing. He spent several hundred pounds a day, very rich man. And the other was women. And he had been, I can only tell you the truth, he had been in a very interesting court case just before the war, when his wife, going through for divorce, his wife claimed that he was still having sex with her at a time when he said they'd separated. So it was an argument. And it turned into rather an interesting argument legally, because she said she was pregnant by him, and he denied it. He said it was someone else. And, of course, it was long before you could test who it was. And the whole thing hinged on whether a woman could conceive in bath water. So not actual penetration, but in bathwater. So you can tell what happened, and he was quite convinced that this he would win the case, and he didn't. The doctors, by a majority of 2-1, decided that it would be possible, which is very surprising. I wouldn't have said that. Anyway, that, I mean, that sort of story, you get a good name in the Navy with that behind you. He was so wealthy. His father had left to them both one of the three large, very large coastal shipping companies of England. We had three very large ones. Corys, who had 20 or 30 coastal steamers, each about 2,000, perhaps 3,000 tons. They only moved coal. They were colliers. The other two were coastline, and all their ships were called by a coast, Barbary Coast, something coast. They were, again, 2,500 tons, and they plied all the way around England, taking cargo and maximum of 7 passengers. If they had 8, they had to have a doctor on board. You couldn't go to any port, any part of the coast of England, without seeing at least 2 of these going by in an hour, and big ships as well. And the third one was Clyde Shipping Company, and the Bom Kidston and his brother Hume, who wasn't with him when I knew Bom, owned Clyde Shipping. And it was interesting, during 1935-6, my father took my brother and myself in a Clyde Shipping Company called all the Clyde Shipping. Ships were named after lighthouses, longships, Rathlin. And we went, joined it at Tilbury when I was 14 or 15, and we went round the coast for a month on a summer holiday, and it ended up in Glasgow. And we were 3 days in Glasgow when the Empire Exhibition was up there. So we went to the Empire Exhibition, came back to the ship using it as a hotel, and we came all the way back, and the whole thing took just over a month. And I was absolutely thrilled. The first time I'd really been to sea. A Rathlin it was, and on the Russian convoys, you always had a rescue ship, which is a little tiny ship, tucked in at the back of the convoy. No one would go for her. And you would pick up, if there were a lot of survivors picked up by destroyers, you'd take them to the rescue ship. But Rathlin was on many, many convoys. And I used to watch her, this tiny little ship, against these huge merchantmen, thinking that the last time I was there, you know, it was up on this, going up to Glasgow as a child. Oh, it was wonderful. So that was it. He had all this money in the world. And we finished the war. It was very, nothing much happened. We rounded up the U-boats, and that was the most incredible episode. You know, it took 2 or 3 days, and they were all put in Loch Ryan, was it? I forget which one.
Where did you tell me about Ryan?
Well, once the war ended, the German Admiralty, whatever it's called, ordered all U-boats to obey us, the Royal Navy, and do what they were told. Some tried to scuttle their ships and some tried to run away. But they all had to surface eventually. And we picked, sometimes you'd go out and find one or two. They'd then signal to say where they were. And we'd go out to meet them and take them, escort them up to around the north of Ireland into, I think it's Loch Ryan, which, and they were moored in there in rows. It's quite incredible. And when we took our last...
Sorry to interrupt. How many were there?
Oh, I don't know, 50? 50 or 60? All we picked everyone up who had at sea, and some left harbour, not knowing what was happening, and we picked them up. But it was most impressive, and they were pretty good. We had no trouble. We always put someone board.
Like? Yes. What were the crews like? What was their attitude to you?
Well, I never got on board one. So, but people if we picked a submarine up, a U-boat, we'd send over a party by motorboat, a petty officer, a couple of hands, all with guns, just in case, with pistols. And one officer, and all he had to do was make sure that they obeyed their orders. Then they followed us, or we were astern of them, gave them a course of steer. And a day and a half later, we had turned them over to the authorities in this lock. And the last time we went up, we took 2 in, and that was about the last 2 to go in. And the others had all been moored in 2, possibly 3 lines. And I remember we went down this line very slowly, looking at all these U-boats, all you'd ever thought of for 5 years had been U-boats. You could listen all day to the sonar on the bridge going bing, bing, and someone shouting, "Echo, sir!" And this was part of your life. And suddenly all that ended, and we went in complete silence. The whole ship's company came out onto the upper deck. No shouting, no nothing. They were numb, absolutely numbed. And we went down, I don't know how many, there must have been 50 or 60 of them. We did down and then came back the other way and went away. That was the last time I'd ever seen a U-boat. It was really annoying, and it was very emotional.
Your enemy.
Our enemy, but they weren't our enemy, really. I mean, it wasn't their fault. They were.
Did you have respect for their?
Yes, very much so. Very much so. But that was an extraordinary thing. And after that, that was the end of the war. We escapade went to Campbelltown in the foot of Mullah Kintyre. And we stayed there because the right at the beginning of my story, I told you what wonderful work was done at HMS Osprey at Portland. During the war, Portland moved up to Scotland, and all the theoretical classroom stuff was done. You have to keep on teaching people, even in war, was at Dunoon. And the practical stuff, with submarines and the destroyers, was done at Campbelltown. And after the war, we went up to Campbelltown and became one of the destroyers working up there with HMS Osprey. And eventually, we and several other destroyers who were working up in Osprey in Campbelltown with us went down back to Portland. And over a period of 6 or 8 months, they reinstated Osprey. All of it back in Portland again.
And you went to Osprey?
We went down to Portland and stayed there.
In HMS Escapade.
Unfortunately, the Escapade was earmarked to be the leader. Remember, I told you in the flotilla that one ship would be a leader with a Captain D, always known as D. And so, dear old Bomb Kidston, always called him Bomb because he had fast cars. He lent me a beautiful Lancia. He went down to Dorset, where he lived, tow puddle, and brought a car back, and he said I could use it whenever I wanted to, and it was a wonderful car. He was fast. He was a racing driver, amongst other things, and a pilot. He could fly, had his own aircraft, and he went down to tow puddle and brought this back, but he was only a lieutenant commander. He wanted to get out of the Navy anyway, and so Escapade was earmarked to be the leader. She wasn't built as a leader, so she only had sort of room for a normal private destroyer. And a new captain, a four-ring captain, was appointed, a record John Holmes. Now, I said that Robert Merrick Ellis was a so-and-so. This bloke was the original so-and-so. There was no worse man I've ever met. He hadn't been to sea the whole war. He was a gunnery officer, so there's two things. And gunnery officers, particularly senior ones, were most objectionable. They thought they ruled the Navy. The gunnery days were over long since. He looked at me as I was far too young for the job, as a very young first lieutenant. And when he arrived, he said, come down to the cabin number one, we'll have a chat. And he said, now, I don't know what you're going to do, but I'm having two staff officers on board. A navigator, a qualified navigator, a man called, I don't know, a young, very nice bloke, his father owned a huge mill. As you leave Windsor and go through Windsor Great Park, on the right-hand side, there's a huge mill there. And he was in that family, so he wanted to get out of the Navy as well. Next time I saw him was at a pub in that area in peacetime, and an open white Rolls Royce. And I wondered who could afford such a thing. Went into the pub, and there he was. The Captain Holmes had said he wanted a navigator, and he wanted a staff officer who was a senior lieutenant commander, Burton. I remember him well. And he said, I want your cabin for the staff officer. And I said, my cabin is a named cabin, sir. Let's say you have eight cabins. Four of those have names on, officially. First lieutenant, engineer officer, doctor, and the gunner T. And those can't be changed. Those people have got to have a cabin. And that cabin designated, nominated. And I said, I'm not moving because it's... And he said, you will move. And I said, I'm very sorry, sir. It's King's regulations and King's regulations and Admiralty instructions. And he said, I don't give a bugger about that. So I went and got KRNI, King's regulations, Admiralty instructions. I found the page, put a piece of paper and took it to his cabin, put it on the desk for him. I said, it's in there, sir. If you don't want to see it, I'll read it to you. He said, nope. He said, I think I shall have to court-martial you, number one. You're being impertinent. And I said, you can do as you please, but I'm not moving out of that cabin. So about 4 hours later, I was sent for. And he said, okay. He said, you stay in your cabin. Who are you going to throw out for Lieutenant Commander Burton? And I said, well, the junior one is so-and-so. And he said, that's not good enough cabin. I said, well, we can change. Only two cabins are available, that or this. He said, all right. He said, you win that case. But he said, I don't want this impertinence again. Do you understand? I said, I do, sir. But I've done enough damage already. And I said, it depends on both of us, I think. We are not going to. And he was furious, absolutely furious. We had endless arguments, and they were serious. They really were. He was a huge man. And fiend, and he did his best to upset everybody. I remember the first time he came into dinner with us in the wardroom, I asked him to dinner. I was the president, the first time, not him. And he set about trying to offend our engineer officer, who was a lieutenant commander, who was a little bit religious, very nice man, but, and he, the captain couldn't bear this. He tried to shock him, and he tried to tell us a story, and he said, when the engineer officer at dinner said, you know, please, could we not discuss? He said, oh, are you worried about brothels? He said, God, I've been in every brothel from Shanghai to somewhere else. With that, the engineer officer got up, left the table, walked out. So after dinner, the captain went to his cabin, I went down to see him, and I said, I think that was wrong of you to do that. So, and he said, that man's a wimp, an absolute fool. He said, fancy being as tender as that. And I said, that's his belief, but if you could next time, please don't aim all your jibes at him, because he's a bit religious. And that was it. It got worse and worse, and finally we did it. I told you he was a gunnery officer. He was making a film with Admiralty approval of gunnery at sea, which was dead already. And we were a German destroyer. We painted ourselves up as Germans. We had submarines working with us and other ships, and with the film crew down there. And one of the things they wanted was fall of shot, the splashes when the shell doesn't hit. And they rigged explosives behind us. We towed from the stern, and by pressing button A, B, C, D, we could create a splash that looks like a fall of shot. Guns in a destroyer are called A gun on the forecastle. The one just below the bridge is B, X and Y down off if you've got four. So we got to the time where he wanted to fire this, and the captain in a loud voice said, fire B, and that was he wanted that. The gun, B gun, was right in front of him, and the bridge is here. The gun was now being turned and up like that, and the sub-lieutenant on, was a man, Priestley, was on B gun. He heard fire B, and he fired B gun as well. It nearly blew the captain's, I think it damaged his ears. He was right over saying, and the gun was as close as I am to you. God, it was a noise. He put him under close arrest. And I said, we haven't got enough officers. What the hell's good of close arrest? Which means an officer has to be with him all the time. I said, he's not going to run away. We're at sea. And he said, all right, put him under open arrest. But when do we get alongside, close arrest? It was too much. And I went up to see the captain of Osprey, who was senior to this wretched man. And I told him. And he said, well, I don't know what you can do. But I said, well, he's driving everyone mad. And he said, well, we'll see what we can do about it. Eventually, about a month later, a Bill Argles, a young, newly promoted captain, took over from this wretched man, who then was appointed to a good job. He went as naval attaché in Washington. It was a very good job indeed. He could have been made admiral from there. And then he did the kindest thing he'd ever done to anybody. He died, dropped dead after 3 months in Washington. Marvelous. And the world was rid of that wretched man. He got his wife down to Portland with three children and a nanny in a house that I recommend, because I had a flat in Weymouth anyway. And I knew of a place, and I got it for him. And he asked me one day, he said, number one, would you go down to the station and meet my wife? She's coming in by train with the children and the nanny and get them to the house. And he said, I'm too busy, which I did. And I told her that her husband was busy, probably wouldn't be ashore till later. She was there for a month. She was very sweet. He went ashore and spent one night in a month with them. He went, I think, twice to see him, and only one night ashore. Always too busy.
And he couldn't.
He had no intention. He was a dreadful man. Thank God he's gone. And that was it.
Yeah. Where were you on VE Day?
VE Day, I was, oddly enough, I was in a submarine at Campbelltown. I was going to see in the submarine to see just how effective our attacks were.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And when we got back in alongside, everyone was screaming and shouting at us, and we'd won the war, apparently. But I didn't go abroad at all. I didn't go to the Far East at all.
Yeah. So what were your feelings on hearing the war was over?
Truthfully, I'm rather sad. Mm-hmm. I couldn't see myself fitting into... The Navy was really could be divided into two. People who didn't give a damn, And people who worried about promotion and made life hell for themselves and everybody else, they were always pushing ahead, pushing themselves. And if they didn't get promotion, they were suicidal. So there was a third lot, the useless blokes like myself, the suicides who were, and the people who finally make promotion. And this sort of backbiting and bickering and competition is no way to live. I enjoyed every minute of the war. Awful thing to say. No, most of the war. I couldn't see myself enjoying the peacetime. And the new captain I had, Bill, you see, I was now a first lieutenant of a leader. And the leader should have a senior lieutenant commander as first lieutenant. I was a junior lieutenant. And Bill, the chap I've just told you, came the day I was going to, the day before I left the ship, I got reappointed. He said, the trouble with you is you were too good, too young. And he said, it's always a failing in the Navy to be promoted when you're young, because they always say, oh, Christ, he's a bit young to promote at the moment. Someone else will do, and they find us. So he said, your chances of promotion are very, very low indeed. He said, look at the size of the Navy. And he pointed out that at that time, one in something like 20, 21 lieutenant commanders got promoted. Something like, almost impossible. So either you don't care, or you work hellish hard and find someone else gets there first. In normal peacetime conditions, it was about one in four got commanders. Short odds, worth waiting for. He said, your chances, until the Navy's run down off the war, there were thousands, we had to get rid of the... He said, the chances are you'll be sacked later on anyway, they'll ask you to retire. And they did. In the First World War, they forcibly retired you. In the Second World War, they asked you whether you would like to retire or not, and I said no. And then I changed my mind and said yes, and then he wouldn't let me go. So I might as well. And he said, enjoy yourself. He said, the only two things you do, work as hard as you can and hope that you can shorten the odds by your brilliance. Or he said, you've run foul of two captains now. I told him about Ellis, but I got quite a good report, oddly enough. But I said, John Holmes, and no, nothing could save me from John Holmes. I mean, when he finally left the ship and he gave me a flimsy, that's when the new bloke arrived, he gives you a shortened version of the official report he sends to Apple. He's called a flimsy because it's only a flimsy version of the original. And everybody salutes him, takes the flimsy, which is wrapped up in an envelope, as he goes over the side, everyone salutes him. He's piped for the last time. I had seen my official report on his desk. He left it purposely in his cabin for me to see on Sunday. And he said, oh, number one, I've forgotten the Bible. We're having a church service. Nip down again. It's on the desk of my cabin. There was my official report. So when he gave me the flimsy next morning as he left the ship, I didn't even bother to open it. I rolled it up and threw it over the side. I last got my own back on him. Extraordinary man. And in the middle of it all, Christmas appeared, the first Christmas of peace, and he said, he sent for me and said, what are you doing about Christmas, number one? I said, well, I've divided the ship, so and so. He said, have you been ashore for Christmas during the war? I said, yes, once. I told him the time I ended up in Poole Hospital for Christmas. And he said, well, I shall be going for Christmas, so you can stay up here and look after the ship. He hadn't been to sea the whole war. 3 or 4 days later, he was taken ill with a very, very severe attack of malaria, which we didn't know he suffered from, and it was really bad. And it was so bad that he wouldn't live in his cabin down aft. He went and lived in his sea cabin up on the bridge because he wanted to get away from it. Terrible headaches, high temperature. And eventually he sent for me and he said, you've won again, number one. He said, you can go home for Christmas. And I said, you are not fit to stay and look after the ship, sir. He said, I'll do what I bloody well please. And he said, that's an order. Go home for Christmas. Sudden different picture of him altogether. But he was a swine, absolute swine.
So, did you have contact with Room 40 at the Admiralty?
I don't even know what Room 40 was. Was it in the Citadel?
I really don't know.
Well, Naval Intelligence was in the Citadel, and I did work in Naval Intelligence. I worked for Naval Intelligence, I told you, in peacetime.
Yes.
When I was in Formosa.
Right. We'll come on to that then in due course. So, with HMS Escapade, where did you go to then?
I finally took her to Plymouth, and she was broken up into razor blades or whatever they do with them. And I paid her off there in that dreadful winter of 47, I think it was, snow everywhere. And bit by bit, we got rid of the ship, turned everything over, and finally I got a signal to say everything had been returned, and she was towed away and broken up. And I went to Royal Arthur. That was at Corsham in Wiltshire, which is a training establishment.
Right. So what did you go there to do?
I was a divisional officer. It was new entry training, and we were training the few ratings that were still coming into the Navy. But it was a big establishment. It also had another part which did petty officer training for senior rates training.
Right. So what sort of people were coming into the Navy in those?
This was purely and simply national service. They were only going to be in for 2.5, whatever it was, years. And the Admiralty reluctantly agreed to take. They didn't want any. We were trying to run down, not increase the size. But the services, you know, turned against the Navy and said, and the government said, they've got to take in a small quota so we could pick. And we got very, very good ratings. They knew they were only going to be there for in national service. They were a joy to take. There was no problem at all. I forget how many. There were four divisions, and folks were foretop, main top, and quarter deck, and I had foretop. Division, new entries.
How long were they with you?
About 3 months.
Uh-huh. And what were you teaching them?
I was teaching them nothing. All my staff taught them. I just was in charge. But
so what was the establishment then?
That was, well how many people? Mm. Oh, it's a huge establishment, and it was in two parts. The petty officers' training was down the road, about half a mile from us, and the main part was at a place called Lipiat, which is just outside Corsham, and it had a huge staff, vast parade ground. We did everything, sport, boxing, rugby, football. We taught them seamanship, and we had no ships to show them. It's miles from the sea. Sort of basic knowledge, so that by the time they got to a ship, they'd know something about it. Mm. And
trainers did you have under you?
I had two warrant officers. Luckily, they were both gunnery officers, and therefore, it was still in the days of warrant officers, only just. And the warrant officers, Dave, were a number, but I had two WOs and a lot of petty officers, no junior rates at all, no junior, all petty officers. And each one had a class, and they were responsible for this class. And if we had a good rating, he didn't particularly want to go to sea, he would stop him. Going, he would back class him so that the next class came through, he would take it through with the petty officer. Mm-hmm. And one such man I had was a bloke called Peter May, who was the captain of English cricket. He went into the Navy, and of course he was good news for the Navy playing cricket. Mm-hmm. So I was told, I was instructed by Admiralty to back class him until he finished his national service. He never went to sea at all. As soon as he'd finished, and of course, once he'd been back class, he was available to play cricket wherever.
Mm. What did you feel about being on land now?
I enjoyed it. It was a promotion job. Mm. The captain was promoted admiral. The commander was promoted admiral. The first lieutenant was promoted to a commodore. He was a great personal friend of Mountbatten, who was then Lord Mountbatten. He's now Duke of Edinburgh. He was a personal friend. So all these people got promoted. I was about the only bloke who wasn't promoted, but I had a history.
what rank were you now?
Lieutenant Commander.
Right. Okay. So you weren't hankering to go to sea?
Nope. Right. No, I'm lying. I wasn't a lieutenant. I'm still a lieutenant. Okay. I'm still a lieutenant. I'm lying. Yeah, I wasn't hankering, and I got an opportunity to go to India. Because Nehru, when he took over India, the partition, clamped down on all for currency, no foreign currency, and all the training of Navy, Army, and Air Force that had hitherto been done in England was done in India. So they recruited people to go out and teach them out in India, and I was one. I went out to teach new entry officers straight from the university.
And whereabouts was that?
Cochin, down on the Malabar coast, south.
Derek Plummer, end of